and carry the cross. This has been a Christ Center Communication message. I'm Vanessa Denha-Garmo, the Communication Evangelist.
Radio for Catholic and other Christians. This is 990 WDEO, Ypsilanti, Detroit, or on the internet at WDEO.net.
This is D.L. Hudson. Welcome to Church and Culture. This show is devoted to exploring the interaction between our faith and our culture. Each week, I will talk with expert guests on topics ranging from literature, art, and music to politics, liturgy, spirituality, and education. Thank you for joining us. My guest in this hour is Julia Bicknell. Julia is talking to us by phone from London. She is the co-founder, director, executive editor of World Watch Monitor, which I'm very excited to share with our listeners because I've been going over the website of World Watch Monitor this morning, and it's certainly a source of information and news that we in this country, especially among people of faith, should know about. The purpose of World Watch Monitor is to report the story of Christians around the world under pressure for their faith and being persecuted and being killed. Julia Bicknell has had over 30 years of experience with the BBC, specifically with the BBC World Service and BBC World. She has been a correspondent from Pakistan, has lived in Vietnam, and has spent extended time in Africa, and she easily has the most interesting resume of any guest I've had on this show. Julia, welcome to Church and Culture.
Gosh, that's quite hard to live up to, isn't it?
Well, I just can't believe you've done all these things in your lifetime that I've read about. It's just quite amazing. You've had a really rich, rich life full of experiences that frankly, make me very jealous.
Well, I guess it was always, you know, as you know, you never quite know what's going to be one step after the other sometimes. And sometimes
right.
You look back and you think, did I really do that? Did I really live there? But I
right.
did.
Like you, for example, covered the first Gulf War.
Yeah, I was actually in Pakistan during the Kuwait War, the first Gulf War. Is that the one you mean, or you mean
yes,
the 2003
yes.
one?
Yes, that one.
Yeah, yeah. So I actually arrived in Pakistan 2 weeks before the Allies were due to take on Saddam Hussein in Kuwait because he was occupying, and they basically gave him a deadline. I think it was January the 16th. And I arrived in Karachi in Pakistan 2 weeks before that, and I actually walked into the office of the British Embassy there because I felt I should let them know that I was there because I was actually on a research trip from my job at the BBC World Service. And they more or less said to me, what on earth are you doing here? And I said, what do you mean? And they said, well, you know, we're going to start this war in a couple of weeks. And I said, well, yes, but Pakistan is on the side of the Allies, isn't it? And they said, well, yes, in theory, but in practice, the people are really pro-Saddam Hussein. So we really want you to go home back to London. And I said, well, I can't do that because I've just let my flat out to some tenants to live in for the 3 months while I'm here in Pakistan. So then eventually they agreed that I could go and live in a house. They first of all, they wanted me to go and live in a house in Islamabad. And I said, well, I'm not going to do that because I've come to travel the country and I've arranged this whole itinerary. And eventually they agreed that as long as I went out into the wilds of the desert for the few days immediately as the war was starting, they thought that might be safe. And so I did actually go out into the wilds of the desert in southern Pakistan with somebody who took me because I was very new to the country. And I honestly, we were walking through markets, and I don't think they'd ever seen a Western woman before.
Really?
It was that
with
remote.
With your flaming red hair?
Yes. Well, I did cover my head. I did take the care to wear a dupatta over my head, like Benazir Bhutto always used to wear, you know, that long scarf. So I wore that, and I wore Pakistani clothes. I actually borrowed, it was quite funny, I borrowed some Pakistani shalwar kameez from a friend when I arrived in Karachi. But as I was traveling around, I later discovered that they were really not at all fashionable, and there are fashions in shalwar kameez, and I must have looked very odd because I was probably wearing a fashion that was about 10 years out of date, but I didn't actually realize that. So I must have looked quite funny to some of the locals, but anyway.
Well, that may have been a point on your side that you were looking
exactly, at. Yes.
I want to remind our listeners that I'm talking with Julia Bicknell from London, who was with the BBC as a journalist, reporter, and newsreader for many, many years. And in 2012 was co-founder of World Watch Monitor, which is such a fine website. I want to go ahead and give the URL for that. It's worldwatchmonitor.org. And as I looked at the page this morning, I found, of course, a story on the murder of Father Jacques Mommel. But I also saw in that story something that I actually want to pay some close attention to, because I think it bears repeating, and that is in the last paragraph, Julia, I don't know who wrote this, you state that in the year ending at the end of October of 2015, there were more than 7,000 Christians killed in that year, those 12 months, and 2,400 churches attacked globally. And that, of course, makes me feel somewhat ashamed in that I've paid so much attention over the last few days to the vicious murder and beheading of this priest from France. But oftentimes, I'm not as similarly outraged when it happens in other places. And I think that's something that all of us need to correct. We should feel equally outraged and equally called to action by each and every incident that happens, no matter where it is.
I mean, that's right. And that it was my idea to do that article.
I had a feeling.
And that was exactly what I thought, was I thought at the time, you know, in fact, for me, Rouen, where Father Jacques was killed, I mean, that felt very local, because, in fact, one of my closest friends has a holiday home and is actually around Rouen.
You're fluent in French as well.
Yes. So I knew, you know, I immediately actually sent her a text, because I just thought, gosh, she could even be driving into that town right now, when I first heard of it on the news. But at the same time, while it feels very close, and obviously it's really horrific, I wanted the world to be aware that this kind of thing is happening all over the world, somewhere every day. A Christian is killed, or a priest is killed, or a church is attacked. And yet we don't have that same, it doesn't go to the top of the news headlines in the way that this one did. So that was the impetus for the article. And then to remind people that there is an organization, and we do collaborate with them, and they're known as Open Doors, and they have offices around the world, they have an office in the US and one in the UK as well.
Where is their US office?
It's actually in Santa Ana on the West Coast, but they have offices in something like 20, 25 countries around the world. And so with them, they compile, and these, I should stress, are the figures that we know about from reported incidents. There may be more than that we just never hear about, but those are the ones.
Where are
aware
the
of.
Most Christians being killed? I mean, we can say the Middle East, but could you be more specific than that?
Well, in the last year, obviously one of the countries that has had the most is actually Nigeria, because the whole ongoing Islamist Boko Haram movement has killed hundreds of people. But it's not only Nigeria. In Nigeria, that Boko Haram is doing that. There's also a real movement across central Nigeria as well by ethnic Fulani herdsmen who are mainly Muslim, and they seem to be attacking Christian farmers. And often it's seen as a land dispute, but it seems from the people that study it very closely that while it may display as land disputes, it's often targeted by an Islamist agenda, and we've got very detailed reports on our website about that. But again, you don't tend to hear about Nigeria so much. And of course, as you said, there's also, it depends which year. I mean, back in 2 years ago, in 2014, when Islamic State invaded Mosul in northern Iraq and a lot of those Christian villages in northern Iraq, then proportionally, you know, quite a few Christians were killed of the population. But
I paid very close to that because I was part of or an advisor to the Bush administration, a Catholic advisor, before, during, and after the invasion of Iraq, and had many friends in Iraq trying to, make order out of chaos, I guess. But part of the chaos was the murderous action against the Christian communities in Mosul and in northern Iraq.
That's
which
right.
is still going on, I assume.
Well, I mean, now we think there are almost no Christians or very, very few Christians left, for instance, in Mosul because it's still occupied by Islamic State. But as you may know, there is a military action going towards Mosul to try and get Mosul back into the hands of the Iraqi government away from Islamic State. And that's coming along. I noticed something on a website a couple of days ago saying they're gearing up for a push against Mosul, and they have been retaking quite a lot of land from Islamic State. So yes, there's very, very few Christians, we think, left in that part of northern Iraq. We think almost all of them have fled. Of course, the ongoing war in Syria, the Christians have been disproportionately affected by that because they've been caught between both the Islamic State but also the other multiple Islamic militia groups. Some people say there's something like about 85, 90 militia groups across Syria, and all of them are often with an Islamist agenda. So the Christians have been affected by that, but that's not to say, you know, alongside their fellow Muslims as well, because of the general war. Aleppo, I was listening to a very moving interview with a surgeon, an orthopedic surgeon, an American guy actually, he sounded American. He actually works out of Chicago, but he goes backwards and forwards to Syria, and he operates in the hospital in Aleppo. And he was talking tonight, actually, on the BBC about the fact that there is a massive battle going on for Aleppo now. And Aleppo has had very strongly Christian areas of the neighborhoods, and some of those are under bombardment and fierce attack even as we speak. So let's not forget what's happening to Christians in Syria. And as we know, you know, there's probably, going back to Iraq, there were about 3 million Christians in Iraq at around the time of 2003, and now people think it's something like about 300,000. So
basically what happened to Palestine after 1946 and 7. Julia, I am very much torn about the American intervention in Iraq, not so much in the first war that you covered, but in under George W. Bush. Isn't it the case that Christians were more or less left alone under Saddam Hussein?
Well, I think they were allowed to live. There were definitely some who would have been, probably tortured and imprisoned. But I think generally people say that under Saddam there was a degree of tolerance and a degree of people living side by side that they haven't seen since the invasion. Yes, I think that's fair to say.
Just because, everyone was scared of him, all the groups.
Yes.
And therefore, it was more a reign of fear rather than one of tolerance, I would assume.
Mm. Yes, but I mean, I think it's hard for me to say because Iraq is, I've never actually been to Iraq, but it's one of the few countries probably in the kind of conflict zones that I haven't been to, because I've been to places like Afghanistan and other places. But my understanding is that as long as you sort of, you know, some people might sort of say, you know, kept your nose clean, you wouldn't get attention from Saddam necessarily unless you really spoke out against him or whatever. And I think probably a lot of Christians were, you know, content to keep their faith private and just get on with their life.
I'm talking with Julia Bicknell. She is the co-founder and executive director of World Watch Monitor, and I want to again say this is such an outstanding website. Julia, one of the things that really caught my eye was a report about something that I had wondered about for quite some time, and that is what has been the fate of the Christian refugees coming into Europe from Syria, for example. And you have a report from Open Doors Germany, who had interviewed 200 Christian migrants from Syria, Iraq, and Afghanistan, and they indeed have experienced a great deal of prejudice from the Muslims they have been housed with. I don't think there's been any outright violence, but they certainly feel as if they're not welcome. I mean, this kind of information just doesn't come across our screen, this level of detail. And I think that if your mission is to provide accurate and fair news accounts of the persecution of Christians, your website certainly keeps that promise. I think it's quite brilliant. It's quite brilliant.
Thank you. Oh. Well, you see, one of the things I often say to people is I am a Christian, and I can't pretend that I'm not. But at the same time, I've also spent 30 years in the BBC, so I write from what I call my BBC DNA, and that means I have to be fair. I have to be as balanced as I can, and I do think that sometimes, reports of Christians being persecuted can be manufactured. They can be exaggerated. And all of that. I mean, somebody once said to me, persecution equals dollars. And there is a sort of an impetus to sometimes say that things happened when they actually didn't. And so one of the things that we work incredibly hard at World Watch Monitor is not to report. We don't just pick it up from the web just because we read it somewhere. We actually do check it out, and we do double check. If one person tells us something, either we know the sources and we know them to be reliable because we've worked with them for the last few years, or we will check with other people. And so that means that there are many stories that you see on the web that we won't necessarily cover because we've checked them out and we don't believe they are as they claim to be.
One thing I appreciate about what I read on the website is, for example, I have a website called thechristianreview.com, and you on your website state that as someone cites World Watch Monitor as the source, you encourage people to repost these stories.
Yes, I mean, we're actually a little bit torn with that now because we've been going for about coming up for four years. We 3.5 to be precise. But we noticed that some people are taking our stuff and not crediting us at all. In fact, I noticed today that another similar news agency was quoting a third agency as the source for the story.
Oh, I hate that.
We know that that story originated with us because we have the phone calls to prove it. So that's a bit.
I think you just have to call them out individually when they do that. Please don't change your policy over that, because we want, and I'm sure you agree, this level of journalism to be as widespread as possible. And you're really also creating a standard for covering religious persecution that so many other sources need to rise to your standard.
Well, thank you. I mean, yes, I sit here and work incredibly hard all day, every day. And sometimes I get up in the morning like everybody and I sort of wonder, you know, does anybody read this? And does anybody care if I take
all this? Well, I'm going to help you. And fortunately, there are several other, a lot of other websites, but several other central news agencies that I can activate to start carrying your stories.
Well,
that have huge audiences. Yes.
Yes, because I think we're you know, when we started, it was quite hard to sort of get our stories into the mainstream of news, because obviously there's so much news pouring out of everywhere all day, and to kind of get that distinctive voice in that says, you know, we're right, this is our focus, we're focusing on Christians under pressure for their faith around the world. And you know, I came to it because I just felt that even I, sitting in the BBC, didn't know about many of the things that were happening to Christians in other countries across the world. And I figured out that if I didn't hear about it, then that meant probably 99% of the rest of the world didn't know about it either. So that
probably you ought to add a few nines to that at the end.
So that was really the impetus, was sort of finding our niche in a very crowded place. But I think, yes, it's slowly but surely we're sort of, you know, getting our voice in there, as it were.
So after over 30 years, or nearly 40 years, am I correct, with the BBC in one way or the other, you sort of launched out on your own?
Yes. I mean, the story is, I really, a little bit along what I was just saying, I felt God tap me on the shoulder, if you like, and I felt him say, here's something that needs reporting. This was before Islamic State rose to prominence. This was before all these attacks that we're hearing about in Europe and other places. But it was very much during the spring of 2012. I just felt, here is something that I don't think I hear enough about as a Christian and as someone who really loves news and as a journalist. And I felt, well, it's the classic thing. First of all, I looked around to see if I knew anyone else, and then I figured that I couldn't think of anyone. And then I thought, well, in a way, if not me, then who? And there were some other things that happened as well. You know, I felt God, you know, God spoke to me through a few people, and different things came together. And so reluctantly, I gave my notice in at the BBC and said, I'm going to focus on this. And it really was because that sense of, you know, who, if not me, then who?
So you do have collaborative partnerships, for example, with the Open Doors,
yes,
that allow you to get more content there than you would be able to do just with your staff.
Well, we have a quite a tight team. We have just around, you know, six or seven people around the world. We're not all sitting. We don't sit together. We all work virtually, but that's people who work with me more or less full time. And then we have stringers who are journalists in the countries themselves who mm-hmm. report to us, to me directly quite often. But alongside that, as well as those, and a lot of freelance reporters as well, and is building that network of Christian, ideally the person who reports for us is a Christian and a professional journalist in another country. And obviously the countries that we're particularly interested are the ones where these incidents happen the most. So it's finding those trusted sources, preferably journalistic, and then also it's using other people's resources and research. And as you mentioned, Open Doors does compile this annual World Watch list, so they are also following this and sourcing it as well. And then there are other people, like we liaise with some of the Christian mission agencies around the world. World Vision is one of them, and then we hear from other people sometimes as well. So it's a question of who's on the ground in that place, and how can we get the information as near to the grassroots as possible.
I want to mention that you like to trek.
Yes.
You like mountain biking. You've recently been to Bhutan, Nepal, North Thailand. You
That's
love
right.
movies, documentaries, and history. We share
yep.
that, except for the trekking. If you put in golf, then we would be pretty much same.
No, I have played once or twice, but it's not one of the things I'm good at or particularly spend time doing.
I would say the places you've been would not be the most fruitful places to find good golf courses. I'm talking with Julia Bicknell, who, again, has founded and directs this marvelous source of information and news about, I'll call it, Christian persecution at various levels, worldwatchmonitor.org. And she is someone who I'm so glad that I discovered, because she's such an incredible resource. She's not only knows about these things, she knows them from experience, from being in the countries, from being a highly experienced and professional journalist with the BBC, which I greatly respect, by the way. And she's been in all these places that most of us only read about. In 1 minute, what's the scariest place you've ever been? Then we'll have a break.
I would honestly say the most scared I've been was in Afghanistan in probably 98, 99, because it was when the, it was after the Mujahideen, but it was when the seven factions of the different people vying for power across Afghanistan were shelling each other from the hilltops. And so I was actually in eastern Jalalabad, and at the same time I was very afraid because one of the factions had actually killed one of my fellow journalists, who was an Afghan who I'd been working closely with. So I remember barricading myself in a hotel room one night and wondering whether I would actually come out of the room in the morning alive or not, but I did.
Oh, my Lord.
So that was probably the most scary place, yes.
Julia Bicknell, let's take a short break, and we'll come right back and talk more about your experience and your wisdom regarding worldwide Christian persecution. We'll be back shortly.
Light of the East, weekends on Ave Maria Radio.
I'm Father Thomas Loya. This week on Ave Maria, the question is often asked, what is the place of women in the Eastern churches? A perspective on this question itself and its answer lies in the context of Eastern liturgy.
Saturday evenings at 8:30 and Sunday mornings at 9 on 990 WDEO Ave Maria Radio.
Last June, Raymond D'Souza talked to the ladies of Heart to Heart Catholic Women's Apostolate.
These mentalities here in the States, when you hear that famous senator from Illinois who said that if a child survives abortion, it must be left aside to die, he is now ruling the country. This is the culture of death. Abortion is a war of the parents against their children. What is euthanasia? It's a war of the children against the parents. What is contraception? It's a war of a nation against itself. Because a nation without children is a nation without a future.
This is Henry Root, your host for Putting On the Mind of Christ. Raymond D'Souza talked about history, necessity, the kingship of Jesus, and devotion to the Sacred Heart. Listen to Putting On the Mind of Christ this Sunday afternoon at 3, encoring Saturday afternoons at 6 on 990 WDEO, 1440 WMAX, and AveMariaRadio.net on the Internet.
Why am I here? Where am I going? And how do I get there?
Join Father John Ricardo as he discusses these crucial questions through the lens of Pope St. John Paul II's Theology of the Body. You'll gain a better understanding of how original sin destroyed our ability to love and how Jesus' sacrifice and God's grace restored that ability. This 4-CD set makes an excellent gift for all engaged and married couples. To purchase your copy, go to AveMariaRadio.net and click on Theology of the Body under the store tab.
I'm back with Julia Bicknell, who is the co-director, co-founder, executive editor of World Watch Monitor, which provides accurate and detailed and probing news reporting on Christian persecution around the world. Julia, let's talk about ISIS, and let's talk about your take on ISIS's status. Now, we hear reports, like you said earlier, that ISIS is being driven back in northern Iraq. We hear reports that ISIS is being driven back in Syria and so forth. But yet we have these horrendous terrorist attacks now in Europe, Belgium, France. We've had now ours in the United States. What is the real status of the strength of, and the reach of ISIS?
Well, I think my understanding is that maybe 2 or 3 years ago, it was only one. Some people might even say, you know, no more than a couple of thousand people in across the Middle East, and obviously one of the issues was that it sort of, I was almost going to say, morphed out of a number of other groups, and particularly one of the groups that we know a lot of the disaffected military officers and people of Saddam Hussein's army, when they were demobilized, they basically were very restless. They wanted to have power. So some of them sort of went into forming all these militias in northern Iraq. So that's one of the many groups that's morphed into what people now refer to as, you know, many people say the so-called Islamic State. The problem is that what's happened is inevitably they probably inspired many other Islamist groups in other parts of the world. So a group called Abu Sayyaf in the southern Philippines, for instance, or a group like Boko Haram in northern Nigeria. And they will sort of say, in fact, some of them have officially sort of, as they would say, sworn allegiance to Islamic State. But that doesn't mean to say that Islamic State as such is kind of a formal organized group. It's just there's lots and lots of other Islamic extremist groups that are now claiming to be inspired as much as anything. So we can't really say whether things are done by so-called Islamic State or whether it's people who claim to be connected or, are being inspired by whatever. The other thing to remember is that a lot of them are disaffected young men. And the key things you have to think about are, as someone explained the other day here in the UK, you know, they're looking for meaning, purpose, identity, and significance. And so when you have a group that can prey on that, particularly through social media, then you can effectively appear much more powerful and influential than you actually are. So, for instance, I was very encouraged just to hear today, this afternoon, that I think it's France has said that it's no longer going to publish the photos of these men that carry out these atrocities in the newspapers and the main media, because it doesn't want to get them or to give them significance. So if that becomes one of the factors that that the rest of the world is realizing they can actually do something about, then you know, hopefully that will lead to a change. But it is really hard because the links may not exist or they may be very tenuous, but nevertheless many people are saying they're inspired by what they've heard about.
Well, let me ask you then two questions. First, if ISIS has a kind of amorphous quality, who is it that says publicly, Yahoo, we, you know, cut the head off a priest in France, or takes responsibility for an action? And the second is this, that we often have heard that ISIS could be defeated because it is a group that is geographically locatable, that you could go in and take them out militarily. And it sounds to me like that's not true.
Well, I think there's two things. I think there probably is a very small, fairly tightly connected group that you could say are militarily and strategically located, but it's more of an idea. That's the difficult thing. It's more of an ideology that has spread, and that's the thing. As many people are saying, you can't root that out of people's hearts and minds. That's a much more difficult thing to tackle, and so that's why although they will, you know, Islamic State will claim on their media that this, you know, that this is their soldiers, we, you know, or whatever, we don't necessarily know that. It's just sort of good for them to be able to say that, if you see what I mean. So, but I think the Western world, the majority world, has to think this is an ideology that, as I said, influences people of for meaning. They are looking for meaning, purpose, significance, identity, those kinds of things. And they're much, much more difficult to tackle, because I think the solution for those things is in the heart of the communities where those young men live. And that's where the work has to be done. So that, I think, more and more, when you're talking about prevention of conflict, prevention of terrorism, you have to be looking at working within those communities in the countries. I do believe poverty is a huge factor that plays into this. I do believe unemployment is a huge factor that plays into it. And that if you can tackle those root causes by development, that is one way of overcoming this concern, this thing that's happening around the world.
Julia, the one of the two terrorists that killed the French priest yesterday actually was wearing an ankle monitor and was allowed, because of some sort of arrangement with the police, 4 hours each morning to go out on his own. And I'm not asking you to explain that because you're not part of the French police, but when we hear this kind of thing in the United States, we kind of just go, what? I mean, if this guy's dangerous at all, you know, why let him out loose at all?
Yeah. I think a lot of Europeans are completely find that absolutely impossible to understand. But I did hear someone from the French authorities this morning explaining that because there is, you know, such a number of these kind of men in France right now, the guy was actually saying they can't keep up with tracking all of them at the moment. France is admitting it's got a security issue. And so, you know, it could be. The other thing that this man, this Frenchman said, is that you have to understand that they are always playing off the risk of further alienating and antagonizing and making these men resent and want to fight, if you like, the authorities, the government, versus a certain amount of, you know, control and, you know, quote unquote, imprisonment. And they felt that if he hasn't committed an offence as such, they feel that it would potentially be more dangerous to, you could say, keep the guy locked up for 24 hours a day than it is to allow him some sort of freedom. Now, clearly, that's gone very, very badly wrong in this particular case. But those are the concerns that they're playing off against. It's a bit like, you know, we Europeans find it completely baffling that there are so many shootings in America, and we just sort of look at it and can't believe how so many people get killed by, you know, by guns every year. And it's a little bit the same, isn't it? You're balancing sort of, you know, freedom of wanting to, you know, defend your person and your property versus the fact that things are often going to go wrong.
Julia, that's a very good point. And I want to remind our listeners who are now putting their handguns under their seats. I'm talking with Julia Bicknell, who is the co-founder and executive director of a wonderful website, worldwatchmonitor.org, about Christian persecution, which we in the United States should know more about and should be making use of. I just signed up for the, I take it, do you send out a daily email? I just signed up for
it. It doesn't go out every day. It's every time we produce a story, which we have a commitment to do at least three a week, and sometimes it goes up to six or seven. I think the most it ever went once, and it nearly killed me, was about 11 stories in 1 week. But usually it's around three or four, five a week. We don't have a daily one. It's just whenever we do a story.
That's good. And because some things that come into your inbox every day, you don't pay as much attention to.
And the other good news I just want to add is that if you don't want, because I know how everybody has so many emails, and I, for one, have too many that I never read. But if you want to choose to follow particular countries or particular continents, you can select on our website.
That.
You don't have to. You don't have to have everything we produce.
Except the list is so long.
Well,
I mean, there must be 100 countries listed
well,
there.
Well, to be fair, if you look at our website, you'll find that actually we narrow down probably to around I would say, 30 or 40 countries, because those are the ones where the concerns are. There are many countries that we never actually report about, but they're on the list because that's the way websites work. But you won't ever get a story about, say, you know, I'm thinking of a country like Ghana. I've never written a story about Ghana, for instance, in this particular context, whereas we're always writing stories about Nigeria, say.
The Christian persecution that you've been tracking for all these years, is it entirely Muslim on Christian, or are there other groups?
It's not at all entirely, no. It's very much, that's one of the things that often, I think, surprises people. One of the biggest stories of this year and the last year is what's happening to Christians in India. Now, you know, we all think of India as the world's largest democracy, probably a country we do business with. Think of it, I mean, I've been to India a number of times, but I never realized that there's a lot of attack on Christians in India right now, along with the minority Muslims as well, from a Hindu president who basically is taking the line that if you are Indian, you are therefore automatically Hindu. And what he's doing is some of the governments, the state governments that are run by his party, the BJP, they are allowing oppression of Christians, attacks of Christians to go on, because they go along with this view that anybody who is not a Hindu must be therefore not Indian. So you have these mass conversions of Christians and Muslims, as they would call it. They don't call them conversions back to Hinduism. They call them homecomings. They're known as gawapsi in Hindu, and that means that they believe these people should never have left Hinduism, and they sort of want to bring them back to their sort of true roots, as it were. And
well,
that's going on a lot.
Christianity has very deep and historic roots in India, doesn't it?
It does. It does indeed. But this Hindu government is really making it very. I mean, here's a good example. They've made Christmas Day an ordinary working day for government, civil servants, the schools, all that kind of thing. So if you've got, and you have millions of Christians in India because it's such a massive country, if you just imagine that day is just treated as an ordinary day and you have to get special dispensation or you have to take annual leave to be allowed to celebrate Christmas. I mean, that's the kind of thing that's happening with this current Indian government. And then there's also, believe it or not, everybody thinks Buddhists are always very peace-loving and very peaceable. You think of the Dalai Lama and other people. But in fact, in countries like Sri Lanka and Myanmar, Burma, there's quite a lot of attacks going on of minority Christians, particularly in rural villages, where people sort of say you can't possibly be a Christian, and they get hounded out of their villages by Buddhists. So it's by no means only Muslims and extremist Islam, which is taking on this oppression of Christians.
I was just watching a classic martial arts movie, The Touch of Zen, last night. And the Buddhist monks were the best fighters in the whole movie.
Well, that is quite interesting, because you just don't think of the Buddhist monks in that way. But there is a movement called Ma Batar in Myanmar, in Burma, and it's quite a militant Buddhist movement. And they are basically saying, again, you know, if you are a Burmese, you must be a Buddhist, and if you're not, then we want to know about it, kind of thing.
Are they actually killing people, or are they just pressuring people?
I think it's a lot more. It's actually, taking jobs away from people, and not allowing churches to be built. It's a lot more sort of harassment and discrimination. But nevertheless, there's one key thing that I know about from Myanmar, where I've been, which is that if you are not allowed to marry a non-Buddhist, if you believe that you are sort of a true Burmese or Burman person, you're not allowed to marry someone of another minority religion. So
well, in each case you're describing, both in India and Burma, you have a faith wrapped into a form of nationalism.
Yeah, That's right. Absolutely. Yeah.
And that's a deadly combination.
Yes. Yes.
What did you think of the arguments, going back to the slaying the French priest, the arguments that were being made, for example, in your UK paper, The Telegraph, that the attack on the priest in the French parish was really an attack on France because of it, the church symbolizes France, not the church.
Well, I don't know that the two attackers would have seen it quite like that.
I don't think so either.
But, I mean, I do think that the interesting way that it's hit France is that it's seen the Catholic Church as symbolic of France and its values, even though, you know, not so many people were at the mass when it happened. And I think that is actually quite interesting. You know, there is this concept in France very much of laïcité and, you know, everything, you know, the separation of church and state. But nevertheless, France has had an incredibly powerful reaction and more or less said, you know, this is enough, you know, enough is enough. And François Hollande, the president, has spoken out very strongly about it. So I see it as more a symbolic thing of one of the places where they felt they could, you know, do something rather than them thinking necessarily all the symbolic consequences of it.
Gee, I think that's a very good point. I spent more time in France probably any other European country, well, Italy, but I always find the arguments about secularism are offset by these very, very deep Christian roots. And you don't get very far smacking around the French church, even to atheists and agnostics. They'll come around. They'll come right back on you. They'll defend the church if you start criticizing it in France. And I think that's wonderful because I think that this may awaken real religious piety. People may rediscover their piety of their parents and grandparents in these tragic circumstances. They may realize that ISIS going after this 85-year-old priest is an illustration of how central Christianity is to the identity of France and Europe in general.
That's right. And I think the other thing to be aware of is that, of course, it totally sickens many, many, many Muslims around the world, not only across Europe and in the UK and in France, but, you know, many other countries. And they are asking, how can this be being done in the name of the religion that I hold? And therefore, they're questioning the roots of their faith as well. If this can be done in the name of, you know, their religion and their God, then what kind of religion and God, you know, is it? And that is causing them to question. And my understanding is, and you'll have seen an article on our website.
I saw it. I read it
recently,
this morning.
You know, what's happening in the UK. And my church, for instance, we have former Iranian Muslims who've become Christians who are now coming to my church in the UK in central London, and other, you know, many other people who've been here for some time. Muslims born in this country are becoming Christians. So I think it's actually... we're praying and hoping that it really will turn people to question the Christian faith more closely as well, because they see the reaction, which is not one of anger and bitterness and hatred and vengefulness. It's one of saying, let's pray, and this is for us all to pray and be peaceful and reconcile with each other and forgive each other.
In fact, this morning I was going back and forth on email with a young correspondent from the Wall Street Journal, a Muslim man who is actually in the process of converting to Catholicism. And he's getting perhaps a little too much attention for his own comfort level. But I did see the article on your website this morning about a church in, I guess it was in Greater London.
It's in the Midlands, in the middle of the country, actually.
And it says, more UK Muslims, refugees convert to Christianity. And it's actually an article from The Guardian, but yet you have it on your website. And again, this is not something that I've read about here in the U.S. at all.
It's definitely happening. And I mean, you mentioned that report earlier from Open Doors in Germany, but also they've found in Germany, and it's quite, you can see it quite a lot in some of the European media. And in fact, PRI, probably one of the rival radio networks to yours, did a short documentary, which again we've linked to on our website. We have a thing called Catching Our Eye. When other people do something that we think is of interest to people who are reading our website and are getting our emails, we kind of flag it up for them so they can go to other places as well. But anyway, what's happening is that these things are going on, and in Germany as well, you know, Muslims fleeing are finding more welcome amongst the churches in Europe than they are many of the mosques, and that's why they're coming. And of course then people are questioning and saying, well, they're just doing it to be fed or to get a house or get a passport. But I genuinely believe that many of them are, because they've seen, as I said before, what's being done in the name of Islam, and they actually find it detestable.
You know, every Muslim I know, and I know quite a few because my son's high school from where he just graduated, I think was about one-tenth Muslim. And so he had quite a few Muslim friends. And they all are horrified by what goes on. But yet, in terms of the U.S. media anyway, you just don't see stories of these Muslims expressing their outrage, expressing their concern. And that, I think, is a real pity. Is this something that you put on your website, these kinds of stories?
We try and do it sometimes. We don't always report when they say things, particularly when they're commenting in the media. But occasionally we do. We've reported on the Grand Mufti from the Al-Azhar Mosque in Cairo, who is kind of like one of the highest authorities in Islam. When he speaks out against something like, say, the blasphemy law in Pakistan or something like that, then we do cover it because we think that's significant, and sort of following the currents of what's being said by some of the major sort of Islamic leaders in the world, speaking on behalf of Christians or peace or whatever it is. We do try and cover those, yes.
By the way, I read the story about the blasphemy law in Pakistan on your website. Could you tell our listeners about it?
Well, essentially, the blasphemy law, believe it or not, was first brought in to stop people of Hindu, Muslim, and Christian backgrounds defaming each other's religion at the time of the British colonial times. But it was really, but I think I read the other day that only about four cases were ever taken in the entire time of his existence under the British. But then it was sort of resurrected, you might say, as a law, particularly in the late 80s. And since then, it's really been used to abuse all sorts of other issues, notably disputes over land or whatever. And essentially, somebody can accuse someone else of blasphemy. And, it's very much one person's word against another. And particularly minority Christians suffer disproportionately from the misuse of this blasphemy law. Now, even the Pakistani courts have said that this law needs to be changed by the Pakistani parliament, and they've sent it back to the parliament. But the problem is the parliament, frankly, are afraid of the reaction of the masses, because the masses are sort of so often being used by political parties to, in using their kind of extreme Islamic interpretation.
Look what Henry VIII did with his blasphemy law.
Yes.
I mean, you can pretty much do anything you want if you've got the
yes,
power.
Yes, exactly. So you know, frankly, the blasphemy law, everybody agrees. I was, again, funnily enough, listening to the son of a man called Salman Taseer, who was the governor of the Punjab, which is the most populous and I think one of the biggest, if not the biggest, provinces in Pakistan. And this governor, who himself was a Muslim, was assassinated because he spoke out against the blasphemy law and in favor of this Christian woman, Asya Bibi, who is still in prison after 5 years, coming up 6 years, I think, for allegedly committing blasphemy, when even the evidence that's been presented in court clearly doesn't support that. And so this governor's son, he was actually taken hostage after his father was assassinated for speaking out as a Muslim, in saying that the laws were unjust and needed to change. His son was then taken hostage for several years and recently been released. But he was speaking out very strongly, saying exactly the same thing as his father was saying, and appealing to the Pakistani parliament, to the Pakistani government, saying this law needs to change. So I do think it's something we have to keep on reminding our governments about, that they can put pressure on the Pakistanis to change this law, maybe through aid and trade agreements and that kind of thing. And you know, maybe eventually a groundswell of opinion will actually make sure that they are overturned or at least amended.
Julia Bicknell, thank you so much for being a guest on Church and Culture today, and I certainly hope you'll come back sometime.
Thank you very much. Very nice to meet you, as it were, over the airwaves.
Yes, and once again, I want to commend to our listeners your website, worldwatchmonitor.org. It's a fabulous source of information, kind of information we are really not getting here in the United States. So, Julia Bicknell, thank you for your work you're doing, and thank you for being here, and look forward to having you back next time.
Thank you very much.
To all of you who've been listening, please stay with me. I have another great guest after this short break.
Seen a copy of the Michigan Catholic newspaper sitting in the back of your church. But have you picked one up lately? If so, you'll find we're not only Catholic news you can trust, but Catholic news you can use. Find out where your favorite priest is being assigned, read our popular Q&A columns, and learn more about your faith by reading the Michigan Catholic. Talk to your pastor or call 313-224-8000 or visit themichigancatholic.com.
Are you a creative mom or dad? Do you do things that you wouldn't find in parenting books? I found that parents nowadays are a little more nervous about trying those creative discipline solutions that we all have stories of from our parents. A mother one time told me she was a little tired of the runaway threats. She'd been getting them every other day. Skip, about 9 years old, came downstairs one day traumatized over cold toast, threatened to split after school. Mom didn't argue with him. She just quietly handed him his lunch, packed in a roadmap. This was back in my early days as a shrink. I was a little squeamish. I said, "Ma'am, you did what?" She said, "I gave him his lunch in a roadmap." I said, "Oh, what state do you live in, ma'am?" She said, "Pennsylvania." I said, "What state did you give him?" She said, "Pennsylvania." I said, "Aren't you taking a heck of a chance he's going to find his way back? You got to give him North Dakota. You know they got one interstate through the missile silos." After this mother was done describing this on-the-spot motherhood, I've never read anywhere about running away roadmap therapy. You have to know what she said next. "Did I handle that right? Was it okay that I did that?" She needed the expert to stamp it. Psychologically approved. She was being a creative parent. She quietly got her point across. "Don't do this to me anymore. Without you folks being creative parents, I can't write books. Because 3/4 of my good stuff comes from you." Nice scam, isn't it? I'm Dr. Ray Guarendi.
Food for the Journey, Sister Ann Shields, on a recent self-discovery of how anyone can subtly help those seeking help from the church.
One of the things I've found out in this era of the new evangelization is how many people are coming into our parishes during Mass, and they're curious, but they don't know what to do. And I've just been realizing that if I pray and say, "Lord, lead me to the person who most needs you,"